I'm right. I love my husband and try to do my duty, and they love me. I think they love me. After everything. I have to think that, Jack. I have to. I sat there and sweated on the red plush while the large, deep brown eyes fixed on me in a mixture of appeal and affirmation. Then she said very quietly now, I have to think that, and think that it'll be all right in the end. Listen, I said. The boss stalled him off. He'll think of something. It'll be all right. Oh, I didn't mean that. I meant... But she stopped. But I knew what she'd meant, even as her voice, lower and steadier now, and at the same time more resigned, resumed to say, Yes, he'll think of something. It'll be all right. There wasn't any use to hang round longer. I got up, rescued my old Panama off the carved walnut table where the Bible and stereoscope were, walked across to Lucy, put out my hand to her, and said, It'll be all right. She looked at my hand as though she didn't know why it was there. Then she looked at me. It's just a baby, she almost whispered. It's just a little baby. It's a little baby in the dark. It's not even born yet, and it doesn't know about what's happened. About money and politics and somebody wanting to be a senator. It doesn't know about anything. About how it came to be, about what that girl did, or why the father, why he... She stopped, and the large brown eyes kept looking at me with appeal and what might have been accusation. Then she said, Oh, Jack, it's a little baby. And nothing's its fault. I almost burst out that it wasn't my fault either, but I didn't. Then she added, It may be my grandbaby. It may be my boy's baby. Then, after a moment, I would love it. Her hands, which had been clenched into fists and pressed together at the level of her breast, opened slowly at the words, and reached out, supine and slightly cupped, but with the wrists still against her own body, as though expectation were humble or hopeless. She noticed me looking down at the hands, then quickly let them drop. Goodbye, I said, and moved toward the door. Thank you, Jack, she said, but didn't follow me. Which suited me down to the ground, for I was really on my way out. I walked out into the dazzling world and down the prideful patch of concrete, and got into my car and headed back to town, where, no doubt, I belonged. The boss did think up something. First, he thought that it might be a good idea to get in touch with Marvin Fry directly, and not through McMurphy, to feel out the situation there. But McMurphy was too smart for that. He didn't trust Fry or the boss either, and Marvin had been whisked off, nobody knew where exactly. But as it developed later, Marvin and Sybil had been carried off into Arkansas, which was probably the last place they wanted to be, on a farm up in Arkansas, where the only horses were mules and the brightest light came from a patented gasoline pressure lamp on the parlor table, and there weren't any fast cars, and people went to bed to sleep at 8:30 and got up at dawn. Of course, they had some company along and could play three-handed poker and rummy, for McMurphy had sent along one of his boys, who, I was to learn, kept the car keys in his pants pocket by day and under his pillow by night, and practically stood outside the door of the back house, leaning on the trellis of honeysuckle with a derby on the side of his head when one of them went there, just to be sure there weren't any shenanigans, like cutting across the back lot in the direction of the railroad 10 miles off. He was also the one who thumbed through the mail first, for Marvin and Sybil weren't supposed to be getting any mail. Nobody was supposed to know where they were, and we didn't find out, not until a long time after. Second, the boss thought about Judge Irwin. If McMurphy would listen to sense at all, he'd listen to sense from Judge Irwin. He owed Irwin a lot, and there weren't so many legs left to McMurphy's stool he could afford to lose one. So the boss thought there was Judge Irwin. He called me in and said, I told you to dig on Irwin. What'd you get? I got something, I said. What? Boss, I said, I'm going to give Irwin a break. If he can prove to me it isn't true, I won't spill it. God damn it, he began. I told you. I'm giving her one a break. I said I promised two people I'd do it. Who? Well, I promised myself for one. The other doesn't matter. You promised yourself, huh? He looked hard at me. Yeah, I did. Okay, he said. Do it your way. If it'll stick, you know what I want. He surveyed me glumly, then added, and it better stick. Boss, I said, I'm afraid it will. Afraid? He said, yeah. Who you working for, him or me? Well, I'm not framing Judge Irwin. He kept on studying me. Boy, he said then, I'm not asking you to frame him. I never asked you to frame anybody, did I? No. I never did ask you to frame anybody, and you know why? No. Because it ain't never necessary. You don't ever have to frame anybody, because the truth is always sufficient. You sure take a high view of human nature, I said. Boy, he said, I went to a Presbyterian Sunday school back in the days when they still had some theology, and that much of it stuck. And, he grinned suddenly, I have found it very valuable. So our conversation ended, and I got into my car and headed for Burden's Landing. The next morning, as soon as I had my breakfast, which I ate alone, for the young executive had left for town and my mother wouldn't get up till pushing noon, I strolled down the beach. It was a fine morning, but not as hot as usual. The beach was deserted at that hour, except for some kids playing in the bright shallows a quarter of a mile off, thin-legged little kids like sandpipers. I wandered on down past them, and as I passed, they paused an instant in their leaping and splashing and gyration to favor me with an indifferent stare from their brown, water-slick faces. But it was only for an instant, for I obviously belonged to that dull and purblind race which wears shoes and trousers, and you don't leap up and down in the bright shallows in shoes and trousers. You don't even walk on the sand and get sand in your shoes if you can avoid it. But at least I was walking on the sand and getting it liberally into my shoes. I wasn't too old for that. I reflected on that with satisfaction, and moved on toward the cluster of pines and the big oak and the mimosas and myrtles, just back from the beach where the tennis courts were. There were some benches there in the shade, and I had the unread morning paper in my hand. After I'd read the paper, I would begin to think about what would happen later on in the day. But I wasn't even thinking about it yet. I found the bench near the vacant court and lighted my cigarette and began to read. I read the front page, every word, with the mechanical devotion of a padre working over the missal, and didn't even think of all the news which I knew and which wasn't on the front page. I was well into the third page when I heard voices and looked up to see the pair of players, a boy and girl, approaching on the other side of the courts. After an idle glance at me, they took possession of the farther court and began to beat the little white ball back and forth, just idly, to loosen up their muscles. You could tell by the first exchange that they knew what they were about. And you could tell that their muscles didn't need much loosening up. He was of medium height, perhaps a shade under, with a deep chest and big arms and nothing extra around the waist. His red hair had a crew cut. Crinkly red hair showed on his chest above the underwear vest he was wearing instead of a shirt, and his skin was an even baby pink, except for the big blotches of brown freckles on his face and shoulders. In the middle of the freckles, his face was all white-toothed grin and the glint of blue eyes. She was a brown, lively girl, short brown hair that snapped when she pirouetted, and brown arms and shoulders above the white halter tied over her breasts, and brown legs flashing above white shoes and socks, and a little brown flat tummy between the white shorts and the white halter. They were both pretty young. They began the game right quick, and I watched them over my newspaper. Maybe the red-headed fellow wasn't trying his hardest, but she was handing him back to him well enough and could make him move around the court. She was even taking a game from him now and then. She was a pretty thing to watch, so light and springy and serious-faced and flashy-legged, but not as pretty as Anne Stanton had been, I decided. I even meditated on the superior beauty of a white skirt which could flow and whip with the player's motion as compared to shorts. But shorts were good. They were good on the lively brown girl, I had to admit that. And I had to admit, as I watched, that I had a knot in my stomach, because I wasn't out there on the court. with Ann Stanton. It was a terrific and fundamental injustice that I wasn't out there. What was that red-faced, crop-headed fella doing there? What was that girl doing there? I suddenly didn't like them. I felt like going over there and stopping the game and saying, "You think you'll be here playing tennis forever, don't you? Well, you won't." "Why, no," the girl would say, "not forever." "Hell no," the fella would say. "We're going swimming this afternoon, and then tonight we're..." "You don't get it," I would say. "Sure, I know you're going swimming, and you're going out somewhere tonight, and you'll stop the car on the way home, but you think you'll be here this way forever." "Hell no," he'd say. "I'm going back to college next week." "I'm going off to school," she'd say. "But Thanksgiving I'll see Al, won't I, Al? And you'll take me to the big game, won't you, Al?" They wouldn't get it worth a damn. There was no use in giving them the benefit of my wisdom, not even of the great big piece of wisdom which I had learned on my trip to California. They didn't know the wisdom of the great twitch, but they would have to find it out for themselves, for there was no use to tell them. They might listen politely, but they wouldn't believe a word of it. And watching the brown girl dance and flash over there against the myrtles and the brilliant sea, I wasn't so sure for the moment that I believed it myself. But I did believe it, of course, for I had had my trip to California. I didn't see out the first set. The score was 5-2 when I left, but it seemed that she might make it 5-3, for the crop-headed fellow was feeding them to her, not too obviously, and grinning out of the freckles when she'd whang them back. I went to the house, changed, and took a swim. I idled out a long way and floated around in the bay, which is a corner of the Gulf of Mexico, which is a corner of the great, salt, unplumbed waters of the world, and got back in time for lunch. My mother had lunch with me. She kept giving me a chance to tell her why I had come down, but I just skirted round the subject till we got to the dessert. Then I asked her if Judge Irwin was at the landing. I hadn't asked that yet. I could have found out the night before, but I hadn't asked. I had postponed finding out. He was at the landing, all right. My mother and I went out on the side gallery and had coffee and cigarettes. After a while, I went upstairs to lie down for a spell and digest. I lay up there in my old room for an hour or so. Then I figured I'd better get on with my work. I eased downstairs and started out the front door. But my mother was in the living room and called to me. It was a strange place for her to be at that time of day, but there she was. She had waited to waylay me, I decided. I stepped inside and leaned against the wall, waiting for her to speak. "You're going down to the judges?" she asked. I said yes, I was. She was holding up her right hand, the back to her, the fingers spread to inspect the polish on her red nails. Then, with her brow ruffled as though the inspection were not satisfactory, she asked, "Oh, politics, I suppose?" "Sort of," I said. "Why don't you go later on?" she asked. "He hates to be bothered this time of day." There isn't any time, day or night, when he wouldn't hate to hear what I'm going to tell him. She looked sharply at me, her hand with the spread fingers forgotten in the air. Then she said, "He's not very well. Why do you have to bother him? He isn't at all well now." "I can't help that," I said, feeling the stubbornness grow inside me. "He's not well." "I can't help it." "You at least might wait till later." "No, I'm not waiting," I said. I felt that I couldn't wait. I had to go on and get it done. The obstacle, the resistance, had confirmed me in that. I had to know, quick. "I wish you wouldn't," she said, and lowered that hand which she had held up, forgotten, in the air the time we'd been talking. "I can't help it. I wish you wouldn't get mixed up in things," she complained. "I'm not the one mixed up in this something."
"What do you mean?"
"I'll know when I've put it up to Irwin," I told her, and went out of the room and the house and walked up the row toward the Irwin place. At least I would walk, hot as it was, and that would give the old bugger a little extra time before I popped the question to him. He deserved the extra few minutes, I reckoned. The old bugger was upstairs lying down when I got there. That was what the black boy in the white coat said. "The judge, he upstairs laying on a bed, he restin'," he said, and seemed to think that that settled something. "All right," I said, "I'll wait till he comes down." and without invitation I drew open the screen door and entered into the shadowy, gracious coolness of the hall, like the perfect depth of time, where the mirrors and the great hurricane glasses glittered like ice, and my image was caught as noiselessly as velvet or recollection in all the reflecting surfaces. The black boy began again to protest. I walked right past him, saying, "I'll sit in the library till he comes down." So I walked past the eyes, of which the whites were like peeled hard-boiled eggs, and past the sad big mouth, which didn't know what to say now and just hung open to show the pink, and walked on back to the library, and entered into the deep shuttered shadow which depended from the high ceiling and the walls of books laid close like stone, and which lay on the deep red Turkey carpet, like a great dog asleep and scarcely breathing. I sat down in one of the big leather chairs, dropped by the chair the big manila envelope I had brought, and lay back. I got the notion that all the books were staring meaninglessly down at me like sculptured stone closed eyes in a gallery. I noticed, as before, that all the old calf-bound law books there gave the room the faint odor of cheese.
This ends Disc 14. All the King's Men, Disc 15.
After a while, there was some movement upstairs, then the tinkle of a bell in the back of the house. I guessed that the judge had rung for the boy. A moment later, I heard the boy's soft feet padding in the hall and guessed that he was headed upstairs. In about 10 minutes, the judge came down. His firm tread came toward the library door. He paused an instant at the threshold, a tall head above the black bow tie and white coat, as though to adjust his eyes to the shadow, then moved toward me with his hand out. "Hello, Jack," he was saying in the voice I had always known. "Damn glad you came by. I didn't know you were at the landing. Just get in?" "Last night," I said briefly and rose to take the hand. He gave me a firm grasp, then waved me back into the chair. "Damn glad you came by," he repeated and smiled out of the high, tired, rust-colored old hawk's head up there in the shadow. "How long you been in the house? Why didn't you make that rascal rout me out instead of letting me sleep all afternoon? It's a long time since I've seen you, Jack." "Yes," I agreed, "it is." It had been a long time. The last time had been in the middle of the night, with the boss, and in the silence after my remark I knew that he was remembering, too. He was remembering, but after he had said it. Then I knew that he had put the memory away. He was denying the memory. "Well, it is a long time," he said as he settled himself, as though he had remembered nothing. "But don't let it be as long next time. Aren't you ever coming to see the old fellow? We old ones like a little attention." He smiled, and there wasn't anything I could say under the face of that smile. "Damn it," he said, popping up out of his chair without any audible creaking of joints. "Look at me forgetting hospitality. I bet you're dry as Andy Jackson's powder. A little early in the day, perhaps, for the real thing, but a touch of gin and tonic never hurt anybody. Not you and me, anyway. We're indestructible, aren't we, you and me?" He was halfway across to the bell pull before I managed to say anything. "No, thanks," I said. He looked down at me, the faintest shade of disappointment on his face. Then the smile came back, a good, honest, dog-toothed, manly smile, and he said, "Oh, come on, have a little one. This is a celebration. I want to celebrate your coming to see me." He got in another step toward the bell pull before I said, "No, thanks." For a moment he stood there looking down at me again, with his arm lifted for the pull. Then he let his arm drop and turned again toward his own chair with the slightest slackening visible, or I imagined it, in his frame. "Well," he said, offering something which wasn't quite the smile, "I'm not going to drink by myself. I'll get my stimulation out of your conversation. What's on your mind?" "Nothing much," I said. I looked at him over there in the shadow and saw that something was keeping the old shoulders straight and the old head up. I wondered what it was. I wondered if what I had dug up were true. I looked across at him and didn't want it to be true. With all my heart, I discovered, I didn't want it to be true. And I had the sudden thought that I might have his drink of gin and tonic and talk with him and never tell him, and go back to town and tell the boss that I was convinced it was not true. The boss would have to take that. He would pitch and roar, but he would know it was my show. Besides, by that time I would have destroyed the stuff from Miss Littlepaw. I could do that. But I had to know. Even as the thought of going away without knowing came through my head, I knew that I had to know the truth. For the truth is a terrible thing. You dabble your foot in it, and it's nothing. But you walk a little farther, and you feel it pull you like an undertow or a whirlpool. First there's the slow pull, so steady and gradual you scarcely notice it. Then the acceleration, then the dizzy whirl and plunge to blackness. For there is a blackness of truth, too. They say it's a terrible thing to fall into the grace of God. I am prepared to believe that. So I looked across at Judge Irwin and liked him suddenly in a way I hadn't liked him in years. His old shoulders were so straight and the dog-tooth smile so true. But I knew I had to know. So as he studied me, for my face must have been something then to invite a reading, I met his gaze. I said there wasn't much, I said, but there is something. Out with it, he said. Judge, I began, you know who I work for. I know, Jack, he said, but let's just sit here and forget it. I can't say I approve of Stark, but I'm not like most of our friends down the row. I can respect a man, and he's a man. I was almost for him at one time. He was breaking the window panes out and letting in a little fresh air, but... He shook his head sadly and smiled. I began to worry about him knocking down the house, too, and some of his methods, so... He didn't finish the sentence, but gave his shoulders the slightest shrug. So, I finished it for him, you threw in with McMurphy. Jack, he said, politics is always a matter of choices, and a man doesn't set up the choices himself, and there's always a price to make a choice. You know that. You made a choice, and you know how much it cost you. There's always a price. Yes, but, Jack, I'm not criticizing you, he said. I trust you. Time will show which of us is wrong. And meanwhile, Jack, let's don't let it come between. If I lost my temper that night, I apologize from my heart. It has cost me some pain. You say you don't like Stark's methods, I said. Well, I'll tell you something about McMurphy's methods. Listen, here's what McMurphy is up to. And I lurched and ground on like a runaway streetcar charging downhill and the brakes busted. I told him what McMurphy was up to. He sat and took it. Then I asked him, is that pretty? No, he said and shook his head. It's not pretty, I said, and you can stop it. Me? He demanded. McMurphy will listen to you, and he's got to listen to you, for you're one of the few friends he's got left, and he knows the boss's breath is hot on his neck. If he really had anything of more than nuisance value, he'd go on and try to bust the boss and not haggle. But he knows he hasn't got anything. And I'll tell you that if it comes to a pinch, the boss'll fight in the courts. This Sybil Fry is a homemade tart, and we can damn well prove it. We'll have an entire football squad in there, plus a track team and all the truckers who run Highway 69 past her pappy's house. If you talk McMurphy into sense, there might be some chance of saving his shirt when the time comes. But mind you, I can't promise a thing, not now. There was nothing but shadow and silence and the faint odor like old cheese for a spell, while what I had just said all went through the hopper inside that handsome old head. Then he shook the head slowly. No, he said. Look here, I said. There'll be something in it for Sybil, the tart. We can take care of that side of it, unless she's got ideas of grandeur. She'll have to sign a little statement, of course, and I won't conceal from you that our side will have a few affidavits from her other boyfriend salted away, just in case she ever gets gay again. If you think Sybil isn't getting a square deal, I can reassure you on that point. It isn't that, he said. Judge, I said and caught the tone of pleading in my own voice, what the hell is it? It's McMurphy's affair. He may be making a mistake, I think he is, but it's his affair. It's the sort of thing I'm not mixing in. Judge, I begged, you think it over. Take a little time to think it over. He shook his head. I got up. I've got to run, I said. You think it over. I'll be back tomorrow and we can talk about it then. Give me your answer then. He put the yellow agates on me and shook his head again.
Come to see me tomorrow, Jack. Tomorrow and every other day, but I'm giving you my answer now.
I'm asking you, Judge, as a favor to me. Wait till tomorrow to make up your mind.
You talk like I didn't know my own mind, Jack. That's about the only thing I've learned out of my 70, that I know when I know my own mind. But you come back tomorrow anyway, and we won't talk politics.
He made a sudden gesture as though sweeping off the top of a table with his arm.
Damn politics anyway, he exclaimed humorously.
I looked at him, and even with the wry, humorous expression on his face and the arm flung out at the end of its gesture, knew that this was it. It wasn't the dabble of the foot in the water, or even the steady, deep pull of the undertow, or the peripheral drag of the whirlpool. It was the heady race and plunge of the vortex. I ought to have known it would be this way. Looking at him, I said, almost whispering,
I asked you, Judge. I near begged you, Judge.
A mild question came on his face.
I tried, I said. I begged you.
What? He demanded.
Did you ever hear,
I asked, my voice still not much more than a whisper,
of a man named Little Paw?
Little Paw?
He queried, and his brow wrinkled in the effort of memory.
Mortimer L. Littlepaw, I said, don't you remember?
The flesh of the forehead drew more positively together to make the deep vertical mark like a cranky exclamation point between the heavy rust-colored eyebrows.
No, he said and shook his head. I don't remember.
And he didn't. I was sure he didn't. He didn't even remember Mortimer L. Littlepaw.
Well, I questioned. Do you remember the American Electric Power Company?
Well, of course. Why wouldn't I? I was their counsel for 10 years.
There wasn't a flicker.
Do you remember how you got the job?
Well, let me see,
he began, and I knew that he didn't, for the moment, remember. That he was, in truth, reaching back into the past, trying to remember. Then, straightening himself, he said,
Yes, of course I remember. It was through a Mr. Satterfield.
But there had been the flicker. The barb had found meat, and I knew it. I waited a long minute looking at him, and he looked straight back at me, very straight in his chair.
Judge, I asked softly, you won't change your mind
about McMurphy?
I told you, he said.
Then I could hear his breathing, and I wanted more than anything to know what was in his head, why he was sitting there straight and looking at me while the barb bled into him. I stepped to the chair which I had occupied and leaned down to pick up the manila envelope on the floor beside it. Then I moved to his chair and laid the envelope in his lap. He looked at the envelope without touching it. Then he looked up at me, a hard, straight look out of the yellow agates with no question in them. Then, without saying a word, he opened the envelope and read the papers there. The light was bad, but he did not lean forward. He held the papers, one by one, up to his face. He read them very deliberately. Then he laid the last, deliberately, on his lap.
Little Pa,
he said musingly and waited.
You know,
he said, marveling,
you know I didn't even remember his name.
I swear, I didn't even remember his name.
He waited again.
Don't you think it remarkable, he asked, that I didn't even remember his name?
Maybe so, I said.
You know,
he said, still marveling,
for weeks, for months sometimes, I don't even remember any of...
He touched the papers lightly with his strong, swollen right finger.
Of this.
He waited, drawn into himself. Then he said,
You know, sometimes, for a long time at a stretch, It's like it hadn't happened. Not to me, maybe to somebody else, but not to me. Then I remember, and when I first remember, I say, no, it could not have happened to me.
Then he looked up at me, straight in the eye.
But it did, he said.
Yes, I said, it did.
Yes, he nodded. But it's difficult for me to believe.
It is for me, too, I said.
Thanks for that much, Jack, he said and smiled crookedly.
I guess you know the next move, I said.
I guess so. Your employer is trying to put pressure on me, to blackmail me.
Pressure is a prettier word, I averred.
I don't care much about pretty words anymore. You live with words a long time. Then all at once you're old, and there are the things, and the words don't matter anymore.
I shrugged my shoulders. Suit yourself, I replied, but you get the idea.
Don't you know? Your employer ought to know, since he claims to be a lawyer, that this stuff...
He tapped the papers again with the forefinger.
Wouldn't stick, not for 1 minute. In a court of law. Why, it happened almost 25 years ago. And you wouldn't get any testimony anyway, except for this little paw woman, which would be worthless. Everybody's dead.
Except you, Judge, I said.
It wouldn't stick in court.
But you don't live in a court. You aren't dead, and you live in the world, and people think you're a certain kind of man. You aren't the kind of man who could bear for them to think different, Judge.
They couldn't think it, he burst out, leaning forward. By God, they haven't any right to think it. I've done right. I've done my duty.
I took my gaze from his face and directed it to the papers on his lap. He saw me do that and looked down, too. The words stopped, and his fingers touched the papers tentatively as though to verify their reality. Quite slowly, he raised his eyes back to me.
You're right, he said. I did this, too.
Yes, I said. You did.
Does Stark know it?
I tried to make out what was behind that question, but I couldn't read him. No, he doesn't, I replied. I told him I wouldn't tell him till I'd seen you. I had to be sure, you see, Judge.
You have a tender sensibility, he said, for a blackmailer.
We won't start calling names. All I'll say is that you're trying to protect a blackmailer.
No, Jack, he said quietly. I'm not trying to protect McMurphy. Maybe,
he hesitated.
I'm trying to protect myself.
You know how to do it, then, and I'll never tell Stark.
Maybe you'll never tell him anyway.
He said that even more quietly. And for the instant I thought he might be ready to reach for a weapon. The desk was near him, or ready to spring at me. He might be old, but he'd still be a customer. He must have guessed the thought, for he shook his head, smiled, and said,
No, don't worry, you needn't be afraid.
Look here, I began angrily.
I wouldn't hurt you, he said.
Then reflectively added,
But I could stop you.
By stopping McMurphy, I said.
A lot easier than that.
How?
A lot easier than that,
he repeated. How?
I could just...
He began.
I could just say to you... I could just tell you something.
He stopped, then suddenly rose to his feet, spilling the papers off his knees.
But I won't,
he said cheerfully, and smiled directly at me. Won't tell me what?
Forget it,
he said, still smiling, and waved his hand in a gay dismissal of the subject. I stood there irresolutely for a moment. Things were not making sense. He wasn't supposed to be standing there, brisk and confident and cheerful, with the incriminating papers at his feet, but he was. I stooped to pick up the papers, and he watched me from his height. Judge, I said, I'll be back tomorrow. You think it over and make up your mind tomorrow.
Why, it's made up.
You'd know, Jack. I went to the hall door. I'll be back tomorrow, I said.
Sure, sure, you come back. But my mind is made up.
I walked down the hall without saying goodbye. I had my hand lifted to the front door when I heard his voice calling my name. I turned and took a few steps toward him. He'd come out into the hall.
I just wanted to tell you, he said, that I did learn something new from those interesting documents. I learned that my old friend, Governor Stanton, impaired his honor to protect me. I don't know whether to be more glad or sorry at the fact, at the knowledge of his attachment or the knowledge of the pain it cost him. He had never told me. That was the pitch of his generosity, wasn't it? Not ever telling me.
I mumbled something to the effect that I suppose it was.
I just wanted you to know about the governor, that his failing was a defect of his virtue, the virtue of affection for a friend.
I didn't mumble anything to that.
I just wanted you to know that about the governor, he said.
All right, I said and went to the front door, feeling his yellow gaze and calm smile upon me, and out into the blaze of light. It was still hotter than hell's hinges as I walked up the road toward home. I debated a swim or getting in my car and heading back to town to tell the boss that Judge Irwin wouldn't budge. Then I decided that I might wait over another day. I might wait on just the chance that the judge would change his mind. But I wouldn't swim till later. It was too hot even to swim now. I'd take a shower when I got in and lie down till it cooled off enough for a swim. I took my shower and lay down on my bed and went to sleep. I came out of the sleep and popped straight up in the bed. I was wide awake. The sound that had awakened me was still ringing in my ears. I knew that it had been a scream. Then it came again, a bright, beautiful, silvery soprano scream. I bounced off the bed and started for the door, realized that I was buck naked, grabbed a robe, and ran out. There was a noise down the hall from my mother's room, a sound like moaning. The door was open and I ran in. She was sitting on the edge of her bed, wearing a negligee, clutching the white bedside telephone in her hand, staring at me with wide, wild eyes and moaning in a spaced, automatic fashion. I went toward her. She dropped the telephone to the floor with a clatter and pointed her finger at me and cried out,
"You did it! You did! You killed him!"
"What?" I demanded. "What?"
"You killed him!"
"Killed who?"
"You killed him!"
She began to laugh hysterically. I was holding her by the shoulders now, shaking her, trying to make her stop laughing, but she kept clawing and pushing at me. She stopped laughing an instant to gasp for breath, and in that interval I heard the dry, clicking signal the telephone was making to call attention to the fact that it was not on its rack. Then her laughter drowned out the sound.
"Shut up, shut up!"
I commanded, and she suddenly stared at me as though just discovering my presence. Then, not loud now, but with intensity, she said,
"You killed him. You killed him."
"Killed who?" I demanded, shaking her.
"Your father,"
she said, "your father, and oh, you killed him." That was how I found out. At the moment, the finding out simply numbed me. When a heavy caliber slug hits you, you may spin around, but you don't feel a thing, not at first. Anyway, I was busy. My mother was in bad shape. By this time, there were a couple of black faces at the door, the cook and the maid, and I was damning them to get Dr. Bland and stop gawking. Then I raked the clicking telephone up off the floor so they could use the one downstairs and let my mother go long enough to slam the door to keep those all-seeing, all-knowing eyes off what was happening. My mother was talking between her moans and laughing. She was saying how she'd loved him, and how he was the only person she had ever loved, and how I had killed him and had killed my own father, and a lot of stuff like that. She was still carrying on when Dr. Bland arrived and gave her the hypodermic. Across her form on the bed, from which the moans and the mutterings were now subsiding, he turned his gray, gray-bearded, owlish face and said, "Jack, I'm sending a nurse up here, a very trustworthy woman. Nobody else is to come in here, do you understand?" "Yes," I told him, for I understood, and understood that he had understood perfectly well what my mother's wild talking had meant. "You stay here till the nurse arrives," he said, "and don't let anybody in, and the nurse isn't supposed to let anybody in until I get back to see if your mother is normal, not anybody." I nodded and followed him to the door of the room. After he'd said his goodbye, I detained him a moment. "Doctor," I asked, "what about the judge? I didn't get it straight from my mother. Was it a stroke?" "No," he said and inspected my face. "Well, what was it?" "He shot himself this afternoon," he replied, still inspecting my face. But then he added quite matter-of-factly, "It was undoubtedly a question of health. His health was failing. A very active man, a sportsman, very often..." He was even more dry and detached in his tone. "Very often such a man doesn't want to face the last years of limited activity. Yes, I'm sure that was the reason." I didn't answer. "Good day, sir," the doctor said, and took his eyes off me and started down the hall. He was almost to the head of the stairs before I called, "Doctor!" and ran after him. I came up to him and said, "Doctor, where did he shoot himself? What part of the body, I mean? Not the head." "Straight through the heart," he said, and added, "A 38 automatic, a very clean wound." Then he went off down the stairs. I stood there and thought how the dead man was shot through the heart, a very clean wound, and not through the head, with the muzzle of the weapon put into the mouth, to blaze into the soft membranes, to scorch them, and the top of the skull exploding off like an egg, to make an awful mess. I stood there and was greatly relieved to think of the nice clean wound. I went to my own room, snatched up some clothes, and then went back to my mother's room and shut the door. I dressed and sat by the side of the big, magnificent tester bed in which the lace-filmed form looked so small. I noticed how the bosom looked slack and the face sunken and grayish. The mouth was somewhat open and the breath through it heavy. I scarcely recognized the face. Certainly it wasn't the face of the girl in the lettuce-green dress and with the golden hair, who had stood by the stocky, dark-suited man on the steps of a company commissary in a lumber town in Arkansas 40 years before, while the scream of saws filled the air and the head like a violated nerve, and the red earth between the fields of stumps curdled with pale green and steamed in the spring sun. It was not the famished-cheeked, glowing face that, back in those years, had looked up eagerly and desperately to the hawk-headed, hot-eyed man in alleys of myrtle, or in secret pine groves, or in shuttered rooms. No, it was an old face now, and I felt very sorry for it. I reached across to take one of the unconscious hands which lay loose on the sheet. I held the hand and tried to imagine how things would have been if it had not been the scholarly attorney, but his friend, who had gone to the little lumber town in Arkansas. No, that wouldn't have helped much, I decided, remembering that at that time Monty Irwin had been married to an invalid wife, the first wife, who had been crippled by being thrown from a horse, and who had lain in bed for some years and had then died quietly and sunk from our sight and thought at the landing. No doubt Monty Irwin had been held by some notion of obligation to that invalid wife. He hadn't been able to divorce her and marry the other woman. No doubt that was why he had not married the famished-cheeked girl, why he had not gone to his friend, the scholarly attorney, and told him, "I love your wife," or why, after the husband had learned the truth, as he must have done to make him walk out of the house and away to all the years in the slum garrets, he had not then married her. He still had his own wife then, to whom, because she was an invalid, he must have felt bound with a kind of twisted honor. Then my mother had married again. There must have been bitterness and dire quarrels all along, mixed with the stolen satisfactions and ardors. Then the invalid had died, Why hadn't they married then? Perhaps my mother wouldn't then, to punish him for his own earlier refusals. Or perhaps their life was by this time set into a pattern they couldn't break. Anyway, he had married the woman from Savannah, the woman who hadn't brought him anything, neither money nor happiness, but who had, after a certain time, died. Why hadn't they married then? I dismissed the question finally. Perhaps the only answer, I thought then, was that by the time we understand the pattern we are in, the definition we're making for ourselves, it's too late to break out of the box. We can only live in terms of the definition, like the prisoner in the cage in which he cannot lie or stand or sit, hung up in justice to be viewed by the populace. Yet the definition we've made of ourselves is ourselves. To break out of it, we must make a new self. But how can the self make a new self when the selfness which it is the only substance from which the new self can be made? At least that was the way I argued the case back then. As I say, I dismissed the question, and dismissed the answer I had tried to give to it, and simply held the lax hand between my own, and listened to the heavy breathing from the sunken face, and thought how in the scream which had snatched me from sleep that afternoon, there had been the bright, beautiful, silver purity of feeling. It had been, I decided, the true cry of the buried soul which had managed, for one instant after all the years, to utter itself again. Well, she had loved Monty Irwin, I supposed. I had thought that she had never loved anybody. So now, as I held the hand, I felt not only pity for her, but something like love, too. Because she had loved somebody. After a while, the nurse came and released me from the room. Then Mrs. Danielle, who was a neighbor of Judge Irwin, came by to see my mother. It had been her telephone call which brought the news to my mother. Mrs. Danielle had heard the shot in the afternoon, but had thought nothing about it until the colored boy at the Irwin place ran out into the yard and began yelling. She'd gone back into the house with the boy, and had seen the judge sitting in one of the big leather chairs in his library with the pistol on his knee, his head canted over on one shoulder, and the blood spreading out over the left side of the white coat. She had plenty to tell, and she was working down the row in a systematic fashion. She told me her story, pried unsuccessfully into my visit there of the afternoon, and into my mother's indisposition. She had, of course, heard the screams on the telephone. And then took her leave without much to add to her basic narrative at the next port of call. The young executive came in about 7 o'clock. He already knew about the death of Judge Irwin, but I had to tell him about my mother. I made it damn plain and without trimmings that he was to stay out of her room. Then he and I went out on the side gallery and had a silent drink together. I didn't mind his presence more than a shadow. Two days later, Judge Irwin was buried in the churchyard under the ghostly, moss-garlanded oak. Earlier, in his house, I had filed past the coffin with everybody else and had looked down at the dead face. The hawk nose seemed to be paper-thin and almost transparent. The usual strong color of the flesh was gone, and on the cheeks there was only the coy tint of the mortician's art. But the coarse, rufous hair, thinner than ever, seemed to stand up electrically and individually from the high-domed skull. The people filed past, looked down, murmured to each other, and went to stand at the end of the drawing room near the potted palms imported for the occasion. Thus, the fact of his death was absorbed effortlessly into the life of the community, like a single tiny drop of stain dropped into a glass of clear water. It would spread outward and outward from the point of vindictive concentration, raveling and thinning away, drawing away the central fact of the stain until nothing at all was visible. I stood then in the churchyard while the process was being completed, and the earth, a mixture of sand and black surface humus, was being shoveled into the hole where Judge Irwin lay. I thought how he had forgotten the name of Mortimer L. Littlepaw, had forgotten that he had ever existed, but how Mortimer had never forgotten him. Mortimer had been dead more than a score of years, but he had never forgotten Judge Irwin. Remembering the letter in his sister's trunk, he had worn his fleshless grin and soundless chuckle and waited. Judge Irwin had killed Mortimer L. Littlepaw. But Mortimer had killed Judge Irwin in the end, or had it been Mortimer? Perhaps I had done it. That was one way of looking at it. I turned that thought over and speculated upon my responsibility. It would be quite possible to say that I had none, no more than Mortimer had. Mortimer had killed Judge Irwin because Judge Irwin had killed him. And I had killed Judge Irwin because Judge Irwin had created me. And looking at matters in that light, one could say that Mortimer and I were merely the twin instruments of Judge Irwin's protracted and ineluctable self-destruction. For either killing or creating may be a crime punishable by death, and the death always comes by the criminal's own hand, and every man is a suicide. If a man knew how to live, he would never die. They filled up the hole and rounded off a neat mound on which they placed a carpet of artificial grass, savagely green, in the churchyard where, under the dense shade of moss and boughs and under the mat of trodden leaves, no natural grass ever sprang. Then, following the decorous crowd, I left the dead man under that green grass of the mortician's fancy, which spared all tender sensibilities the sight of raw earth, and proclaimed that nothing whatsoever had happened, and veiled, as it were, all significance of life and death. So I left my father and walked down the row. I had by this time grown accustomed to think of him as my father. But this meant that I had disaccustomed myself to thinking of the man who had been the scholarly attorney as my father. There was a kind of relief in knowing that that man was not my father. I had always felt some curse of his weakness upon me, or what I had felt to be that. He had had a beautiful and eager young wife, and another man had taken her away from him and had fathered his child. And all he had done was to walk away, leaving her in possession of everything he owned, and crawl into a hole in the slums and lie there like a wounded animal, and let his intellect bleed away into pious drivel, and his strength bleed away into weakness. And he had been good, but his goodness had told me nothing except that I could not live by it. My new father, however, had not been good. He had cuckolded a friend, betrayed a wife, taken a bride, driven a man, though unwittingly, to death. But he had done good. He had been a just judge, and he had carried his head high. That last afternoon of his life, he had done that. He hadn't said, "Look here, Jack, you can't do it, you can't. You see, I'm your father." Well, I had swapped the good, weak father for the evil, strong one. I didn't feel bad about it. I felt sorry for the judge as I walked down the row by the sea, but as far as I myself was concerned, I didn't feel dissatisfied with the swap. Then I thought of the other old man leaning over the half-wit acrobat in the grubby room and holding out the bit of chocolate to the tear-stained face, and I thought of the child on the rug before the fire and the stocky black-coated man leaning to him and saying, "Here, son, just one bite before supper." Then I wasn't so sure what I felt. So I quit trying to decide. There was no use trying to probe my feelings about them, for I'd lost both of them. Most people lose one father, but I was peculiarly situated. I had lost two at the same instant. I had dug up the truth, and the truth always kills the father, the good and weak one or the bad and strong one, and you're left alone with yourself and the truth, and can never ask Dad, who didn't know anyway and who is deader than mackerel. The next day after I was back in town, I got a call from the landing. It was a Mr. Pettis, who it turned out was the judge's executor. According to what he said, I was, except for a few minor bequests to servants, the sole heir. I was the sole heir to the estate which Judge Irwin had saved, years before, by his single act of dishonesty, the act for which I, as the blameless instrument of justice, had put the pistol to his heart. The whole arrangement seemed so crazy and so logical that after I'd hung up the phone, I burst out laughing and could scarcely stop. Before I stopped, as a matter of fact, I found that I was not laughing at all, but was weeping and saying over and over again, "The poor old bugger. The poor old bugger." It was like the ice breaking up after a long winter. And the winter had been long. Chapter 9. After a great blow, or crisis, after the first shock and then after the nerves have stopped screaming and twitching, you settle down to the new condition of things and feel that all possibility of change has been used up. You adjust yourself and are sure that the new equilibrium is for eternity. After the death of Judge Irwin, after I got back to the city, I felt that way. I felt that a story was over, that what had been begun a long time back had been played out, that the lemon had been squeezed dry. But if anything is certain, it's that no story is ever over. For the story which we think is over is only a chapter in a story which will not be over, and it isn't the game that's over, it's just an inning, and that game has a lot more than 9 innings. When the game stops, it will be called on account of darkness. But it's a long day. The little game the boss was playing was not over. But I'd nearly forgotten all about it. I had forgotten that the story of Judge Irwin, which seemed so complete in itself, was only a chapter in the longer story of the boss, which was not over, and which was itself merely a chapter in another, bigger story. The boss looked across the desk at me as I walked in and said, "God damn it, so the bastard crawled out on me." I didn't say anything.
"I didn't tell you to scare him to death, I just told you to scare him."
"He wasn't scared," I said.
"Well, what the hell did he do it for, then?"
"I told you a long time back when the mess started he wouldn't scare."
"Well, why'd he do it?"
"I don't want to discuss it."
"Well, why did he do it? God damn it," I said. "Didn't I tell you I didn't want to discuss it?"
He looked at me with some surprise, got up from his chair and came around the desk.
"I'm sorry," he said, and put his heavy hand on my shoulder. I moved out from under the hand. "I'm sorry," he repeated. He'd been quite a pal of yours at one time, hadn't he?
"Yeah," I said. He sat back on the desk and raised one big knee to clasp his hands around it.
"There is still McMurphy," he said reflectively. "Yes, there is McMurphy, but if you want any blackmailing done, get somebody else to do it." "Even on McMurphy?" he asked with a hint of jocularity, to which I didn't respond.
"Even on McMurphy," I said.
"Hey," he demanded, "you aren't quitting me."
"No, I'm just quitting certain things."
"Well, it was true, wasn't it?"
"What?"
"What the judge did, whatever the hell it was."
I couldn't deny that. I had to say yes, so I nodded and said, "Yes, he did it."
"Well?" he demanded.
I said what I said. He was studying me drowsily from under the shag-down forelock.
"Boy," he said then, soberly, "we've been together a long time. I hope we'll be in it together all the way. We've been in it up to the ears, both of us, you and me, boy."
I didn't answer. He continued to study me. Then he said,
"Don't you worry. It'll all come out all right."
"Yeah," I said sourly, "you'll be senator."
"I didn't mean that. I could be senator right now if that was all."
"What did you mean?" He didn't answer for a moment, not even looking at me, but down at the hands clasped around the crooked knee.
"Hell," he said suddenly, "forget it."
Suddenly he released the knee, the leg dropped, the foot struck the floor heavily, and he lunged off the desk.
"But nobody had better forget, McMurphy and nobody else, that I'll do what I gotta do. By God, I'll do it if I gotta break their bones with my bare hands."
And he held the hands before him with spread fingers, crooked and tense as though to seize. He sank back against the support of the desk then and said, half as though to himself,
"That fry now, that fry."
Then he fell into a brooding silence, which, had Fry been able to see it, would have made him very happy to be way off there on the Arkansas farm with no forwarding address left behind. So the story of the boss and McMurphy, of which the story of Judge Irwin had been but a part, went on. but I had no hand in it. I went back to my own innocent little chores and sat in my office as the fall drew imperceptibly on, and the earth leaned on its axis and shouldered the spot I occupied a little out of the direct, billowing, crystalline, consuming.